You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Thanks for everybody who has joined us today for this assessment, for this event on assessment in the COVID era. There is a lot to talk about, obviously, with education disruption all over the world over the last year and a half, coming upon 2 years. Not only are there questions about what should education systems do to support students learning in this time, but how should they assess learning? There were hot debates before COVID hit on how to assess learning, debates around academic versus 21st century skills, debates around large-scale summative assessments to assess system-level diagnoses versus formative assessment to really help improve teaching practices, getting the balance right between those. We have been doing work over the last several years, led by my colleague Esther Kerr, with many partners, including the Global Partnership for Education and others, around the world, from our Optimizing Assessment Above All work. And this is the first in a series to build on the reflections we've had from that work over the years for this unique moment in time. I am going to be taking audience questions. I'm Rebecca Winthrop from the Center for Universal Education. I'll be your moderator today. You can tweet them at hashtag 2021 CS assessment. And thanks to all of you who've already sent in questions. We've got lots and lots of questions coming in beforehand. And I am really pleased to be joined by a wonderful panel. I'm very grateful for their time. As I already said, my colleague Esther Kerr, who is a non-resident senior fellow with us at the Center for Universal Education at Brookings. She's also a professional fellow at the University of Melbourne. I'm also very pleased to have Horacio Alvarez Marinelli join us, who's a senior education specialist at the Inter-American Development Bank, really based in Panama at the moment and leading work there in that country. And Javier Gonzalez, who's director of SUMA and also a lecturer at the University of Cambridge, will be joining us. And last but by no means least, Irvashi Sani, my other CWE at Brookings colleague, who's a non-resident fellow with us and also the CEO and founder of the Study Hall Foundation in India. So all of you, please come to the screen. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you. Horacio, Irvashi, Javier, please put your videos on, Esther too. Let's see. So the first question that I wanted to pose to all of you was really to help set the scene for the audience. And it's really around, you know, how are countries thinking about assessment right now, countries or jurisdictions that you work with, and what are some of the debates and trends that you are finding? Esther, let's start with you.
Fine, thank you, and hello to everybody. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning. I think the thing for me about assessment in this particular climate is that we can't talk about assessment as though there is just one solution. So we can talk about all the different functions of assessment. As Rebecca just mentioned, we can talk about summative and formative, but we really need to focus on what is needed right now. What do we need to assess under the pandemic conditions? And what are the data for? You know, in principle, of course, assessment targets should always reflect what is being taught. So what is being taught now that might be different from pre-pandemic? Is it different? And in some cases, yes, it is different. What we're seeing is streamlining of curricula to focus on essential learning competencies. In the Philippines, for example, I know that something like 60% of the learning competencies identified throughout the curriculum have been put aside so that the country can focus on what is most essential. And the intended focus of those sort of competencies are what's required for the students to be able to continue on to next grades and ultimately a successful life. So at least aspirationally, it's about research skills, it's about reading comprehension, it's writing, it's map reading, it's hypothesizing. And they're presumed to be the competencies that we can't always learn outside of the school. Whether that intention is actually reflected in modified materials that are being provided to students is another question. And whether the assessment is aligned with those new approaches to learning is another question. And in my experience, assessment approaches seem to be remaining in the main precisely as they were. They're focusing on rote learning and the minutiae of sort of metalinguistics and equations and so on. And so we need to be thinking about what is our capacity to align assessment with what is being taught. And we've got three things that impact on that. We've got the infrastructure resources. So what is the availability of useful assessments and what are the delivery modes that are possible? We've got issues of teacher expertise. Do they know how to develop assessments that link with the way we're teaching now and the materials that we're teaching? And in terms of student and parent engagement, what's happening there? Because they've been used to a very different medium. How do they suddenly shift and start thinking about learning in a different way, particularly because they don't have the guidance of teachers face-to-face? So before we move on, I actually just want to make one more thing clear. I think we're sort of talking broadly about four different teaching and learning conditions. We're talking about face-to-face. Some countries are still doing that, have done that on and off. We're talking about distance learning that might be enabled by really lovely technologies and infrastructure so that there can be online synchronous learning. There can be distance learning that is enabled by TV, radio, chat and SMS. And there can be distance learning that is enabled by hard copy materials. And if you think about each of those four, what we're talking about is we're moving further and further away from teacher interaction and teacher-supported learning. So what do each of those four conditions mean for assessment? And so that's something that I'd very much like to explore and understand more about. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Esther. That was a great sort of meta global picture of sort of key themes and contexts, which you do always so beautifully, that we need to think about. And also really bringing up, which I know you always do in our conversations, the need for nuance and diversity when we think about our approaches. Javier, can I turn to you now? I'd love to hear your take from sort of a Latin America perspective. Where is Latin America in all of this? What are you seeing? And are you seeing what Esther's talking about? Do you see different things?
Definitely. Thank you so much for the invitation, first of all. And it is a very important topic for the region and for the world, indeed. And we're seeing from SUMA, working with governments, a lot of movement in terms of assessment and different trends. And I think for maybe the non-specialist, maybe to build on what Esther was saying, we have definitely distinguished between the summative, at least the summative and the formative assessments. The summative is to verify basically what students are learning. The formative is somehow to provide feedback for teachers and, of course, for students. So one, I would say, is assessing of learning, and the other one, I would say, it's assessing for learning. In that sense, let me maybe distinguish between these two trends. In regards to summative assessment, well, we see basically three trends that I would like to point out. One is that we see a consolidation of national institutions of education evaluation in the region. We have ICFES in Colombia, we have INEVAL in Ecuador, we have INED in Uruguay, etc. So in the last 15 years, at least, or even 20 in some countries, we have seen a progressive and quite strong move towards summative assessment. And of course, we think this is important because, of course, it allows governments especially to better channel support and better channel to know the weaknesses. Now, the interesting thing is the second trend is that we see throughout the region a more profound understanding of summative assessment. And many of them allow to go into one of the main challenges of Latin America, which is inclusion and inequality. So assessments today allow to distinguish what are the outcomes and the results for different types of students. For example, to detect gender differences, to detect ethnic backgrounds, such as, for example, Colombia, Ecuador, and Mexico. They include this kind of gaps. Socioeconomic backgrounds in most of the countries, but especially Colombia, Brazil, Mexico. So first is the consolidation, then the deepening of this kind of instruments that I think are very important. And thirdly, the use of these instruments for accountability, something that has been suspended in many cases, which I think it's, it's something different that's happening now because of the pandemic. Many of these have been suspended. In this case, in the region, I think, and I would like to point out, at least from my opinion, this is a more kind of a negative trend, is that until now, assessment, some of the assessment has been used for accountability to pressure really schools to perform, regardless sometimes of their context and the poverty, the material poverty of the context. So in that sense, I think we have to grow much more and balance this summative assessment with more support for schools. So that's on the summative part. Let me be very quick on the formative assessment. I think during the pandemic, we have seen a very virtuous and positive trend towards a formative assessment, which of course is very important because, well, actually, as evidence shows, one of the most important practices actually is feedback and informative assessment. It can provide up to 5 months, equivalent of 5 months improvement in education. And so we see this, and maybe I want to put out the example of Colombia, in the case of Evaluar para Avanzar, in the case of Chile, we have as well in this country two tools of more kind of formative assessment. One is called the progressive assessment, which is two times in a year. So it allows, but it's more kind of a centralized system. And then there's also a decentralized system for formative assessment. Now, just to finish with the Latin American context, I would just like to point out that although we're moving in a correct direction, in the proper direction of moving towards more formative assessment, there are, of course, certain barriers of the region that make it maybe more unique and that we have to be very cautious. One barrier has to do with material conditions. And I want to point out for example, in the case of Argentina, 45% of teachers teach in three or more schools. And that is definitely a barrier for providing good feedback to students if you're, of course, working with many students in three or more schools. The second condition is the non-lecturing time. We see in many countries, teachers don't have enough non-lecturing time. That means very little time to really prepare classes and, of course, to assess and provide feedback. In the case, for example, in the case of Chile, last reforms have moved from 25% of the non-lecturing of the whole contract for non-lecturing time to 35 or even 40% in the case of the poorest. And then finally, just to mention, and as I was saying, the importance of teacher training. Teachers have not been really trained to provide really fine formative assessment, and that's something that we have to really look in detail. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Javier. Horacio, I want to come to you because you are based in Panama. You know Latin America very well. What would you want to add to what Javier said? What are you seeing in Panama, and or if you're, you know, also thinking about other countries you specifically worked in? And I also wanted to ask you about this summative versus formative assessment. I know you have strong opinions. Where are you coming out on it?
Okay, so we've seen it, like Javier said, a trend all over Latin America in the last 20 years to have a summative assessment, and institutions that are dedicated to evaluating education quality. However, I think Esther pointed it out that at some point these institutions were made attempting to assess the quality of the system, but the feedback for the providers, feedback for teachers, for schools has been lagging behind. So as I mentioned in a previous conversation with you, you know, for example, we did national testing here in third grade in Panama, and it's taken us 4 years to get back the results to teachers. Same case in Colombia, where the results of the assessments take between 1 to 2 years to return back to the schools, even though at some point they were they were individualized tests. So that type of logistics, the logistical part, like Javier mentioned, we have still many challenges in the region to do this in a way that impacts directly the children that we're serving at that point when we do this national assessments and such exercises. I would say that in this point in time where we are right now, and Javier mentioned it, and I think Esther also did, is we need to strengthen teachers' abilities to do formative assessment, to know where their students are when they come back to face-to-face learning. Here in Panama, for example, kids have been almost out of school for 2 years. They left in March 2020, and this today, I would say more than 50% of students are not yet in school or are not receiving regular in-class schooling. So we need to give the teachers the instruments to assess. Now, I would go further and say we need to give them the instruments to teach. Because as you know, prior to the pandemic, we had half of children in Latin America didn't understand a simple paragraph in third grade. So this is half of the children. And when you look at it from in terms of the quintiles, the differences between the lowest 20% and the highest 20% is really, really high. You have some countries where 90% of poor children do not know how to read in third grade. That means we have a problem of instruction, of schooling, of how the teacher, you know, does what they do. So they will have a problem with assessment. So at the same time, when we do formative assessment and we develop these tools for teachers to learn to assess better, we also need to give them structured materials, which has been proven all over the world to work. Structured materials for teachers that probably have not been trained very well in their initial training process. So I would add that we don't only have a problem of assessment, we have a problem of instruction. And we've had it for a long time, and the pandemic caught on to us, and now we are in a probably much worse situation than we were before.
Okay, great. I wanted to push you, could just come back to you in a minute here on this structured assessment, structured instruction, scaffolding teachers, structured lessons planned, et cetera. There is a lot of debate about that, an argument, particularly from teachers who say, look, you know, this is very stifling. It's stifling my creativity. You're supposed to be able to be responsive to teacher, to your students' needs. And, you know, I wanted to see what your reaction is. What's your reaction to that? What I ask you?
Well, it is true in some cases, but not all teachers are expert teachers. And as in Latin America, and I think we've talked about this before, as you have also very heterogeneous situations in the classroom with different types of students in the classroom, You also have a very heterogeneous assignment of teachers because of how our systems work, how we deploy teachers around countries. For example, a teacher in Bogota, Colombia, where 25 or 30% of the teachers that are in school have doctorates or master's degrees is very different from a teacher in Caquetá, in Arauca, in what it's called the Antiguos Territorios Nacionales in Colombia, or in Cartagena, who sometimes just went to a normal school, or who went to normal schools on the weekend plan. You know, they studied Saturday and Sunday, and Saturdays, Sundays, and Fridays, and that's how they got their teaching degree. So it's we have to think that teachers are not the same all over the place, that if we prepare these materials, some might not want to use them, but to many, it is a really good resource for improving their performance with students, which is what in the end we want. And, you know, what we did with Let's All Learn to Read, Aprendamos Todos a Leer, which is this program that we did in Colombia, is we took like a balanced approach for instruction, where we gave structured materials to teachers with some leeway, but they had the resources to be able to teach, for example, in this case, early literacy. So some might not use them, but many, many will, and will find it useful for themselves. And another point I wanted to make, but this has more related to assessment. We cannot develop all these, and I understand, we need national assessments to see how the systems are performing. But I would say, mention the case of Colombia, you have a national assessment policy, but you don't have a textbook distribution policy. So how do teachers do this? They don't have textbooks. You go into a classroom, and depending on the classroom, even in the same school, you might find in early reading instruction a teacher with three different textbooks trying to teach children how to read from three different guidebooks. How do they do this? We think they're super teachers. You know, they're heroes for doing this. But, you know, we can't have a national assessment policy when we don't have a national textbook policy to support teachers.
Point well taken. And I think you two are also really pulling out what Esther laid out around the need to have a really nuanced view of this. So, you know, scaffolding might be exactly what's needed in structured guidance for new and inexperienced teachers, as long as those who are much more high skilled aren't forced to use it, I think is what you're saying. Irvashi, let's come to you. Tell us about India. What's happening in India? And also, you know, on the ground, you are very much on the ground with your organization, Study Hall Foundation. So tell us what's going on and what your thoughts are of what are the strengths and weaknesses of the approach.
So first of all, thank you for inviting me. I'm glad you asked about what's about the country level and what's happening on the ground, because I'll echo what Esther said, that there are policies and then there's what's happening on the ground. So in terms of policy, well, first of all, India, you know, is very diverse, very complex. We have the government school system where 55% of our students go, and the private school system, 45% of them go there. But in terms of schools, 72% of the schools are government schools and the rest are private schools. So, and then we have states and then we have center. So we have state boards and we have assessment boards and curriculum boards, and then we have central boards. The central board, so let me talk about the central board, which is the Central Board of Secondary Education. And it's considered a very progressive board, and well, it actually is in terms of the policy. So what we have done during COVID, of course, everything went berserk. We have summative assessments and formative assessments according to CBSE, though summative assessments have a higher point and formative assessments have a lower point. And those are meant just to track children, their internal exams, and a lot of schools just fudge them. The mark so that the summative becomes big, and it's only 20% of the weightage given to that. So what happened these last 2 years in 21 is that there were no assessments. They took, in fact, class 10, class 11, and the pre-board marks. And I'm just talking about secondary, because those were considered. As for the others, there were no assessments at all, and they were just promoted two grades, by the way, with no assessments at all. And in many cases, no teaching at all, because the internet penetration is only 24% in the country. Or there was TV broadcasting, et cetera, but no assessment. And I'm talking about the broader system. Yeah. Of course, schools like ours and foundation, we did do that, but I'll come to that a little later. So there were no assessments. And for these, they gave 50% weightage to class 10, because that's a summative board exam again. Class 11 was 40%, and class 12 was the pre-board exam, which is 10%. And they took a cumulative of that, they moderated them, and then they came out with a list which were used for college entrances, which is why those are really so important. Let me tell you the policy though. What CBSE did was that even, you know, we had the National Education Policy come up just very recently in 2020. That has a huge focus on higher order thinking skills. They're even dialing back the curriculum. And CBSE sent out this notice to all our schools saying that we must emphasize higher order thinking skills and not rote memorization. Assessments must look at, and I'm going to read verbatim, by the way, that there will be a greater number of competency-based questions, or questions that assess the application of concepts in real life, unfamiliar situations in the question paper, and there will be art-integrated projects, and that we will be looking at higher order skills like analysis, critical thinking, and conceptual clarity, and assessments will be targeted towards that. Of course, to echo what Horacio and Javier said, that Anesta, that there's very little teacher preparation for that, for teaching of these skills. Right? Even though there might be papers, there's very little, and I'm talking again about the larger country level policies. So what has happened with schools? So that is all up in the air. Right now, what has happened, there's huge learning gaps. Because as I told you, in much of the country, there was no teaching. So people are just struggling with how to bridge those gaps. And like you said, Horacio, they haven't come up with any tests. And they've left it to teachers' creativity that, okay, test them and then bridge the gaps. Okay. And so we are of schools like ours that have been used to doing formative assessments, that have been used to working with higher order thinking skills and working with our students continuously. We find it easier to make that transition. And of course, we are testing it. We are just putting the curriculum away for the time being and say, no, we'll just focus on taking the kids from where they are and moving them along. In terms of what we have been doing as an organization, during this time, we of course have been working with online teaching and connecting students wherever they could. What the teachers have done on their own is that they've been using formative assessments, and they've been calling them practice tests. To your point, Horacio, some creative teachers, look how good they are. And then they said, and then we have unit tests, which is our short-term summative. And of course, they've done no annual summative. They said, no, we can't do that. We just haven't taught them enough to do that. And they have so many things going on that we can't do that. What they've also been doing, and we did that even before this, you know, we have gender education as part of our curriculum. So with every test, they have included a question about gender to test what they learned during our critical dialogues. And they marked that. And they included it as part of their summative assessment as well. Now, of course, parents in this, during this time, like you mentioned, Rebecca, once, that even though when you ask them, they want all these wonderful things for their kids, but when they test them, all they're looking at is, well, do they know how to read, write, and do they know how to do that test? Right? And you can't blame them, because the whole system is geared towards those tests. College entry is not looking at higher order thinking skills. There are no tests for that as yet. They're looking at, what did you get? Can you read and write? Any job is looking at, can you read or write? So until the whole system changes, I don't see how parents are going to change. So if you ask me, there needs to be a huge mindset change everywhere. We have the new education policy, and the government is working very hard. By the way, the Central Board of Education, the CBSE, they're trying very hard to train teachers online, to start thinking along this side, right? At the same time, right now is not the time for them to put all these higher order thinking skills, either the instruction or the assessment, in place, because things are so, schools have opened and they want, everything is crazy right now. Everyone is just struggling to just catch up. There was an assessment that said that 92% of the student population has lost at least one maths skill, and 88% at least two language skills. And this comes from the Green Deal Foundation. So see, even the assessment is just, what have they lost in this? Nobody's really looking at what have you gained? Because what has happened during this time is that there's been a lot of peer learning, there's been a lot of self-learning, there's been a lot of research working, and there has been a lot of resilience that students have shown during this time. So people are recognizing that. And of course, mental health problems. But there's no way of assessing that.
I want to pick up on the survey sheet. It's very interesting what you say, because you basically have said, look, students have gained a whole, people are struggling all over the place, but there is also a number of competencies and skills that students have developed and teachers, the way you're talking about teachers coming up with new ways and creative ways of trying to reach out to families and make connections and their students. And how do we is there an opportunity to capture that moving forward, if we can sort of pivot and orient towards a new way of assessing? But I also hear you saying we need to be very careful how we sequence that, because the system is so overburdened and adding a whole new thing might sort of break the camel's back. I don't know if people use that term. So I want to come to that, because for all the panelists, I want to pick up on what you're saying, Purvashi, because we have a number of questions that are around that theme. And they're around sort of opportunity for shifting assessment systems amid crisis. And they're around asking about the balance of sort of focusing, Esther, you talked about it, that the teaching and educational experience has changed amid COVID, but the assessments are the same. It's very much, math formulas, sort of very narrow academic sort of knowledge-based tests. And there's a whole set of questions saying, can we also shift to look at what kids have learned and look at a mix of academic competency plus 21st century skills? So I'm just going to throw these questions out here as a cluster, and then I'm going to come to you, probably Esther, starting with you first again. So we have Charlotte from NCEE here in the US, and she is really asking, can we use COVID as an opportunity to rethink assessment? And really, worried about now in the US, of course, there's lots of assessment. So this might be very, again, differentiated based on the country context, but she's also quite worried about anxiety, stress and anxiety of these assessments as they are, if they're plowing forward and students really aren't prepared. So that's one question. We have Yasmin from Leap Ed in Malaysia, who is asking about basic literacy and numeracy skills versus 21st century skills, and are literacy and numeracy skills part of 21st century skills, and how do we assess that suite? We often call that in Brookings, we talk about breadth of skills, which is not the same as saying what your curriculum is. When we say breadth of skills, we're looking at competencies, and you can certainly get critical thinking and collaborative problem solving, et cetera, through a science class or a math class or literature class. So when we talk about breadth of skills, that's what we're talking about. And I think she's asking about the balance. And we also have Denise from Academy Health, who's asking about the same thing, but with a mental health lens and thinking about social emotional learning as a piece of what we might want to track over time. So that's a bundle of topics, but they all kind of relate to each other. Esther, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, thanks, Rebecca. I mean, I think that each of those questions, we could disaggregate them and talk for the 24 hours. Though, of course, that's part of the problem, that there's so much talking and so much aspirational activity. And the problem is that we have to think about what is happening on the ground. And I don't think that this is a matter of an either or. So for many years and still under the pandemic conditions, I cannot see that we need to be making a choice between foundational literacies such as reading, writing and arithmetic and what we call 21st century skills, talking about problem solving and critical thinking and metacognition and collaboration. I don't see any reason why we need to have a dichotomy here. My view is that the skills need to be integrated throughout subject studies such that the students are encouraged to learn more deeply in all of their subject areas, because they're applying the skills. They're questioning, they're hypothesizing, they're exploring, they're building knowledge. And I know that there is a perspective among some in that cognitive skills in particular are just only relevant to the more senior students, or they're only more relevant to the students who are higher achieving. And that's a nonsense from my perspective. We can teach anyone how to think about learning, how to approach learning, how to solve problems. And if we can encourage reflection or metacognition, that empowers the learners to engage in the independent learning. And what we're hearing from country, national systems world over is saying that their learners must now engage in independent learning because many of them are not in the classroom. So they are put back on their own resources. And because they're having to rely on their own resources, we need to further develop these skills where they can actually can take control of their learning. You know, we could say it's too late. We could say they should have been taught in this way for many years. That hasn't happened. And it makes it even more difficult now where you're presented with a different mode of learning. You're presented with an environment where you don't have the support of your teachers and you don't know where to move first. So if we think about the fact that teachers need to be able to focus on application of learning, that would be a main focus. If they only rely on traditional, as Rebecca was saying, rote memory learning and assessment, then under pandemic conditions in particular, the assessments are not going to contain valid data, right? We can't pick up summative data. We can't pick up routine type assessment results in a valid way at the moment because you do not have control over the child in the classroom under standardized conditions. And so from that perspective, personally, I don't see a great deal of sense right now in summative assessment, apart from the fact that at different times in different countries in different regions, we're going to have to help students and teachers make decisions about where they slot back into classroom learning. What year level do they go into? And so there we move into another topic altogether, which is around readiness testing. So I'll back off that for now and just stay with this application of learning. And as Rebecca mentioned, we did quite a lot of work in thinking about how can we help teachers as well as assessment groups think about assessment of these learning to learn skills, critical thinking and problem solving in our project Optimizing Assessment for All, which was both in Asia and in Africa. And what we started there was the process of developing assessments that targeted application of learning. And that was through, at that time, an explicit focus on the skills as a strategy to help assessment developers and teachers start thinking about how then do you teach and what do you want to see coming out of the students. One of the things I've been fascinated by in our discussion, as well as I think we're finding more generally, is, you know, in the past when you had a webinar or a seminar or a conference on assessment, it was all about assessment in terms of development of items and tests. Now, when we have discussions about assessment, it's about how do we need to vary the curriculum? How do we need to use different pedagogical approaches? How do we make sure that the textbooks actually support and are aligned with the assessments? So I think we've come a long way, but the problem for us, and again, Horacio and Javier and Vashi talked about this, is that it's one thing to talk about you need to go there and do it. It's another thing to equip the teachers to do that.
Right.
So I'll pass back to you now for, yeah.
Thank you. I think I'll go to Horacio. Horacio, what are your reactions to that? How does it play out in Panama or across other countries in Latin America?
I fully agree. And but I would say that the main skill that you need to learn all other skills is reading comprehension. So it's very, very hard for me to think about how you develop critical thinking when you don't have children who know how to read. And I fully agree that we need to do, and it's not an if and one or another, that we need to test 21st century skills or fundamental skills. But it's really hard when we have countries like the Dominican Republic, where I worked for a while, where you have 81% of students not being able to understand a text by third grade. How do you teach critical thinking? How can you think critically when you cannot get information from text? It is extremely hard. Of course, you can do a lot of exercises. Of course, there's many things that you can do. But the challenges we faced in the region before the pandemic started are so huge. We let our systems in general, I would say, with a few exceptions, fail our children. Because what we also do, and at least in Latin America, is the child doesn't know how to read, he doesn't learn, he doesn't acquire the skills, and then we fail them. And in countries like my own, in Guatemala, it's almost 30% of first graders have to repeat the grade, and many don't come back. So we have to build upon these systems that have already these challenges before we got into the pandemic. And we've had, so far, I would argue, a waiting to fail model. We wait for them to fail, whether it's in first grade or third grade. At the end of the year, say, well, you didn't acquire all the skills that you needed. You're going to have to repeat the grade. Whether you come back or not, we're not that, sure if you will. And this is why we also have in Latin America, about 50% of kids don't finish high school, because the system expels them. So we have to think of whatever changes we do and whatever interventions and policies we do regarding assessment, regarding 21st century skills, that this is where we're coming from. It's not all of a sudden, and I've heard this a lot, the systems are going to perform better. What makes us think that a system that was underperforming, that teachers who didn't know how to teach before the pandemic are all of a sudden going to become up to speed to do it in a different way and to rethink our education systems? So I fully agree that we need to focus, and I would argue even more, on socio-emotional well-being for when these children come back to school, because of all the challenge this they faced during the pandemic. In the case of Panama, we were practically 4 or 5 months, the children couldn't go out of their houses. They are going to face, socialization challenges, how to communicate with other kids, how to resolve, problems, because they have not been socialized for such a long time. We have to take care of that. A lot of them have lost family members, or have their parents have lost resources and income, and they're facing food insecurity. So we need to think of all these issues before we think, okay, we need to do a national assessment. Maybe we need to do a national assessment for some grades, to gauge where we are. But I would think the focus needs to be on socio-emotional well-being and evaluating that and giving teachers tools to do that, and on the fundamental skills that didn't allow them before to learn independently, and that didn't allow them to learn independently during the pandemic, and that won't allow them, if they don't have them, to learn independently after the pandemic.
Okay, great. Thanks, Horacio. Irvashi, I see you want to come in here.
Yeah. In terms of Horacio, I just wanted to respond to a couple of things that you said, that, that reading, yes, very, very important, of course. And by the way, in terms of the state board also, they have made a special mention, and they want special focus on reading, and they understand that it's really important. In terms of, can you have critical thinking without reading? I think you can. And this comes from your own Brazilian Paulo Freire. How can we forget him? That the idea of critical dialogues, having them regularly in the classroom, to enable critical thinking, and Oracy is enough for that. So it really, and it can happen in every subject area that you teach, provided the pedagogy is tweaked to that and the instruction. And the other thing I wanted to respond to, that have teachers changed? I think they have, by the way. What happened was everything changed and they had no choice but to change. Many of them went along kicking and screaming, and some of them just rose to the occasion. And what they did, I know in our own foundation that we in fact had an instruction that they did it. I think the creative quotient spiked along with the COVID, and so did the caring quotient spike. We were talking about social and emotional learning. In fact, many teachers spent a lot of time in just grief counseling because people had lost, and they had lost loved ones too. And then asking all the time, how are you? And reaching out and helping, because they understood that people were in distress. And that's the first thing they did. They started their lesson with, how are you? We hope you're well. And what's going on at home? When they spoke to parents, that was the first question they asked. And that's how they built the bond. Secondly, there was a huge amount of self-learning that happened. They had to just measure up. They did a lot of research, enormous amounts. They weren't just waiting for someone to tell them what to do, because there wasn't anyone to tell them what to do. And in fact, even the government, by the way, this time, reached out far and wide that we need materials, we need help. And even now, they've reached out to organizations like mine. What are the tests that you're using for kids who are coming back? How are you bridging the gaps? And we are helping. I'm on the steering committee of the National Education Policy and on another committee nationally. And that's what we are trying to lend them. All the materials that people have done, there was a national teacher platform with different kinds of pedagogies that has been spread all over. I agree with the point that when things are so much up in the air and there's so much catch up to do, of course, you have to focus on foundation and you're just worried about how to catch up. I think it would be such a good idea if people were to try and assess all the good things that have happened, how children have measured up. Because they'll do two things, even for poor children, who, by the way, are more resourceful. And they've had so little resources that they had to count on their own. They're very resilient. They have a lot more world knowledge. If somehow that could be, that learning could be considered valuable enough to legitimize and make official, can you imagine how that would soar? That they would suddenly be, you know, that we learned. Just because we can't read and write doesn't mean we don't learn. We do learn. And yes, they will be more eager to learn to read and write because we have validated the knowledge that they bring. And I wish there was a way for us to also validate everything that teachers have learned. And organizations like ours are continuously asking teachers to document their learnings. What right. is it we want to keep from the COVID experience?
And they do it. Thank you, Urvashi. You, Horacio, can you respond very briefly in a minute?
Yeah. I was thinking about what Urvashi was saying. And yes, I do agree that you can do critical thinking like exercises without reading. But in order to get to deep learning, you need to go out then and survey and have the knowledge and the background knowledge. And that comes through reading. And I was in a panel yesterday with Javier, and critical thinking skills have been going on in, you know, elite schools in Latin America for a long time. And I remember I was in third, fourth grade, and teachers like, well, you're going to debate a subject. You need to be informed. Go to the library and research it. You need to have the skill to read in order for it to be deep. Otherwise, we can carry on dialogues and based on our opinions, have a conversation for, you know, second grade, you know, whether you like strawberry or chocolate ice cream. But in order to go deep, you need to comprehend and go out to get knowledge, because the basis of critical thinking, I would argue, is to have enough knowledge so that you can counterpose different approaches or experiences.
All right, I'm going to intervene because Urvashi is posting in our little panel chat, but yes, even but you don't have to be literate to be a wise and profound and deep thinker. There's other ways to get knowledge. So we could have this debate for a long time, I can see, but I wanna switch and I wanna come to Javier to a different topic, which actually Urvashi, you put on the agenda, which is practical, interesting, new, creative approaches that are sort of opened up at this moment around assessing learning, and could we look at different ways of carrying it out and different types of knowledge and competencies to assess. And I want to come to you, Javier, because you lead SUMA, And you look for all sorts of creative ideas that have could have practical traction for quite a, in your day job. And I want to see what you think about that. And note that we have several questions around that topic. We have one that asks that question vis-a-vis the lens of ed tech. How helpful can technology be in terms of innovative new approaches that we think we want to keep that are useful that have emerged? And we have a question around really practical ideas for engaging parents in thinking about assessment. So Javier, over to you.
Perfect. Thank you, Rebecca. And just to hop in just a little bit on the, to piggyback on the last discussion, basically.
Yes, please do.
No, very quickly, but because I think innovation is key, of course. But I think it also, I don't think you have to choose really among both. I think it depends on the pedagogical strategies that you use. For example, if you use project-based learning in science, you can learn foundational mathematical skills and critical thinking and collaboration skills, for example, working in a project. So I think that's it goes a lot back to the pedagogical skills that we use to learn each one of these. Of course, from a constructivist perspective, foundational skills are definitely key. I'm with Horacio in the sense of this lack of foundational skills are a barrier for progressing along the school system in Latin America. Just to put some figures out there, 56 before the pandemic, 56% only of students finished completed secondary education. Now it will go back to 42%. Only 42% of students in the region complete secondary education, and the percentage in the poorest quintile will drop by 20 percentage points. So foundational skills are key. And I just wanted to say that, of course, also high order skills are key. And let me just point out that I think this old debate that it seems to be a 21st century skills, I go back to Bowles and Gintis here with the hidden curriculum kind of discussion. These skills really are the elite skills. They have been, and Horacio was just saying, we were also in a panel yesterday, we were talking about this, the same topic from a curricular perspective. These skills have been there and developed in the elite schools. And the difference with the 21st century skills is that we want to democratize these skills in all the education systems. So they're not really new at all. The new thing is actually that we want to provide them along the system. Now, going back to your question really quickly, and sorry for that, I didn't want to miss that point. There are, of course, a lot of innovation in the region. As you say, from SUMA, we developed several issues. We synthesize evidence. We have a map of innovation. Now we have a call open for educational justice, social justice. It's a call for innovations, but in the assessment. I think, as I was saying, the trend is going from summative to formative, and we're very happy with that new trend. And we see this, and let me put, just because of time, maybe three examples. One is the case of Colombia with Valor para Avanzar, which delivers guidelines and a lot of training for teachers and support and monitoring to assess students' skills on the ground with different toolkits, etc. You have the case of Chile, La Agencia de Calidad, which has these two quite new instruments, the progressive one, which is a centralized and more standardized test, but it's given at the beginning, in the middle, and the end of the year. So it's more than summative. It's kind of a formative assessment. Plus, now with a lot of, again, guidelines and items, et cetera, available for teachers to do also a formative assessment. And the last, maybe just because of time, let's say Guatemala, and because Horacio is here, in Guatemala, they're doing quite interesting. They're opening what is called Aprendo en Casa, and they will do a whole period. And just to say also in terms of innovation, of course, I'm going from the government perspective first, then I'll go to NGOs and all kinds of things. But it's interesting to see many countries that they are leaving already, they're planning for a 5-week, 6-week period in March when the new year starts in many of these countries to do formative assessment. So what they're asking students is, and they're preparing students, is to reach that phase of face-to-face schools with a portfolio of different homeworks, et cetera, and projects that they have done through the year and through this time in the COVID. And they will be assessing that during these 5 weeks and working the students to do some leveling up. So that's, I think it's quite interesting, again, how we're moving to formative assessment and also to kind of starting to plan leveling and feedback exercises for the year. That's from the government side. Now, in terms of the private sector, NGO, local actors, there's a lot of, and you were mentioning ICTs. I think there are two things that I want to say. First of all, I think the COVID showed how weak we are in the region in terms of internet. The figures that we had, it was that there was a lot of penetration and cell phones, et cetera, et cetera. And even among the strongest countries, that really, it was more of a myth of connectivity. Because one thing, of course, is to be connected to maybe just to Google or something like that. But another thing is to be able to really assist an online class, et cetera. So, and I don't have too much time to talk about this.
But Javier, can you wrap up in 30 seconds?
Yeah, in 30 seconds. So there's a lot of asynchronic and synchronic platforms. I just want to say, I think, so one thing is that we're quite weak, but on the other hand, there's a lot of development in terms of different tools coming from WhatsApp, for example. WhatsApp has been quite a good tool, and there's a different ARIS, CISO, different platforms, quizzes, et cetera, and others developed in Latin America that are being used in Latin America to basically provide items and ways of easily monitoring the learning, I mean, the learning process of students. So there's a lot going on there. Of course, not too much time to talk about that, but again, a lot of innovation happening.
Great. Thank you, Javier. That was very comprehensive in a short period of time. We appreciate it. So we have 3 minutes left. What I'd like to do is just give Urvashi and Horacio 30 seconds key takeaways for the audience. And then I'll come to Esther last to maybe wrap up key themes you see across. Horacio.
Sorry, finding my unmute button. So I would argue that again, to wrap it up, let's focus on kids' well-being now that they go back to school, on their socio-emotional well-being. They've been out of school for quite a bit and they've gone through a lot, and let's give them the tools, teachers, the tools to assess where they are so that they can help and build them up. I think that would be my main takeaway. Never forgetting that, of course, there's more to reading and math. There's more in life to reading than math, but that they're the basis of the riparian and their future academic.
That was great. 30 seconds. One thing, Urvashi, one thing. And then Javier, and then
okay, so the country and the world actually was held hostage by technology for these 2 years. And lots of creative, wonderful things happened because people had to. I think we should hang on to that, hang on to all the lessons learned. And I know to use technology more creatively to increase outreach, to increase learning, and to enable and support teachers. I think that's really important.
Great. That was a perfect 30 seconds. Javier, your 30, sort of one thing.
One idea. I think the move towards formative assessment is the right move in the region. The thing that I think we have to promote much more balance is that until now we had grown too much in terms of summative assessment and assessment in general, but what we do with that assessment is that I think we're lacking on that, and we have to balance with more support. So state support for schools and teachers is quite needed. We cannot advance in more accountability measures, et cetera, if we don't advance in supporting them. okay. for change. Thank you.
Great. All right, Esther, over to you to wrap up. Two minutes.
Oh, lovely. Thank
a rich you. Conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a lot of areas that we somewhat disagree on, not greatly, but there's some there. The problem, I think, with a focus on formative assessment is that it assumes that a teacher is able to act on that information and to vary the instruction. And if you think about the four learning conditions that I outlined earlier, the opportunities for teachers to vary their instruction on the basis of formative assessment data coming back can be incredibly limited. So quite apart from adopting the different teaching approaches that we're seeing from streamlined curricula, another challenge is the appropriateness of the assessment tools themselves. Have the countries adjusted those assessment tools in line with the streamlined curricula? And is there actually an opportunity for the teachers to differentiate their instruction? And by and large, quite honestly, the opportunities are incredibly limited. And so we've got patterns of streamlining curriculum. We've got acknowledgement of the need for formative assessment because we understand that the different children have different needs. We need to do readiness testing to ensure that we can slot the children back where they need to when they get back to school. But in the meantime, teachers are just trying to stay alive and keeping up with delivery of learning. So the trend has been to adapt what was done pre-pandemic and in face-to-face instead of us thinking differently. So let's now put ourselves in the situation of a child in a remote area where they have some hard copy materials, the parents are illiterate, the materials are not in mother tongue. How does a teacher possibly deliver learning under some of these conditions? And I understand we've got a huge diversity of conditions worldwide, but they're the sort of ground scenarios that national systems and teachers and people like us need to start thinking about, not to be incredibly aspirational, but think what can be managed for that child in that house in a remote village somewhere. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, that is perfectly timed. We are exactly at time. So I want to give a huge thank you to you, Esther, and Urvashi, and Horacio, and Javier. Many thanks for joining us. We had a very lively dialogue and lots of other questions we couldn't get to. So we will have a second installation of this discussion on assessment coming up in about a month. So stay tuned and thank you, everybody. And good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Have the good rest of your day or night.